Imagine this, something as everyday as salt. I mean, it's in almost everything we eat, but did you know it's linked to health issues affecting, well, over 1.4 billion adults across the globe? That number alone is staggering. And it really points to this massive health challenge, hypertension, high blood pressure, which then dramatically increases your risk for cardiovascular disease and tragically for higher mortality rates. At its core, this problem, it kind of boils down to a global dietary imbalance. We're eating way too much sodium and not nearly enough potassium. Now, traditional public health efforts, they've often tried to tackle this by telling us to simply eat less salt. But let's be honest, that's a huge behavioral change for most of us, right? And it's been really, really tough for people to stick with long term. So our mission for today's deep dive is to explore a different path. What if there was a remarkably simple kind of dual action solution, something that could significantly cut your sodium intake and boost your potassium, all without you having to drastically change how you cook or eat? Today, we're diving into the really compelling evidence for potassium-enriched salt substitutes. It sounds like a simple swap, but it has potentially powerful life-saving implications. But like with any potent tool, there are critical safety considerations and some major hurdles to actually getting people to use them that you absolutely need to be aware of.
Yeah, and what's truly fascinating here, I think, is how the very basic building blocks of our bodies, our cells, are right at the heart of this, both the public health challenge and its potential solution. Understanding the why at that foundational level, that cellular physiology, really helps us grasp both its effectiveness and, crucially, its potential risks.
Okay, let's dig into the scale of this then. The World Health Organization estimates that hypertension is directly responsible for, get this, 10.8 million deaths every single year. Globally, the average person consumes about 4.3 grams of sodium per day. That's way above the recommended less than 2,000 milligrams. And at the same time, our average potassium intake is only around 2.3 grams per day, way short of the recommended, what is it, over 300 to 500 milligrams? That's a huge gap, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. And it's precisely that difficulty people have, making those big sustained changes to cooking and seasoning. That's why those traditional salt reduction approaches often just, fail to truly move the needle on a population level. Exactly. And this is precisely where these potassium-enriched salt substitutes come in as such a promising public health opportunity. Their composition is quite clever, actually. They basically replace a portion of the sodium chloride, that's your regular table salt, NaCl, with potassium chloride, or KCl. Sometimes they add other minerals, too, like magnesium sulfate. But the key is this dual action. Yeah. You simultaneously reduce sodium intake, and you increase potassium intake. The profound advantage here, and this is what makes it so potentially effective, is the minimal need for behavioral change from the user. Often the taste is, pretty much indistinguishable from regular salt. And that is absolutely critical for getting high adherence rates and achieving long-term success, for any big public health intervention.
That dual action makes a lot of sense. But to really get why it's so powerful, maybe we need to unpack the fundamentals. Like, how do sodium and potassium actually work in our bodies? What's the unseen mechanism there?
Right. It's like this finely choreographed ballet happening inside you constantly. Sodium, it's primarily found outside your cells, in the fluid surrounding them. There, it's absolutely crucial for controlling how much fluid is in that extracellular space. Think of it as a key player for your body's external fluid volume, which, directly influences your blood pressure. And it's also vital for nerve impulses and muscle function, of course. Potassium, though, is the complete opposite. It's overwhelmingly found inside your cells. Something like 99% of your body's potassium is intracellular. This massive difference in concentration across the cell membrane is fundamental. It maintains the cell's electrical potential, allows nerves to conduct impulses, and sets the resting rhythm of your heart. And maintaining these separate environments precisely, that's managed by something called the sodium-potassium pump, or NAC plus K plus ATPase, if you want the technical term. This thing is a really sophisticated and very energy-intensive molecular machine embedded in cell membranes. For every bit of cellular energy, it uses every ATP molecule. It actively pumps 3 sodium ions out of the cell and at the same time brings 2 potassium ions into the cell. This process, it's called electrogenic. It creates a tiny net electrical imbalance across the membrane, like one less positive charge inside each time it cycles. And that tiny charge difference is fundamental for how cells, especially nerves and muscles, communicate and function. Yeah, the importance of this pump, it really can't be overstated. It's absolutely essential for, vital functions like your kidneys filtering waste and reabsorbing nutrients, and for your neurons firing signals, generating action potentials. Actually, it's so crucial that this pump activity, just in the brain's gray matter, can consume up to like 3/4 of its total energy budget, just maintaining that balance.
Wow. Okay. So these ions have these opposing roles maintained by this energy-hungry pump. How does that connect directly to something like blood pressure regulation?
It's a very direct and powerful link. So high dietary sodium intake tends to increase that extracellular fluid volume we talked about. More fluid outside the cells puts more strain on your cardiovascular system, your blood vessels, and that directly raises blood pressure. Potassium, on the other hand, it helps control blood pressure through a couple of key mechanisms. First, it actually promotes the excretion of sodium in your urine. So it literally helps your body get rid of excess sodium. Second, potassium has a direct effect on your blood vessels themselves. It helps to ease tension in the blood vessel walls, a process called vasodilation. It affects the vascular smooth muscle cells, relaxing them. This reduces resistance to blood flow, which in turn helps lower blood pressure. It's this dual action helping shed sodium and directly relaxing blood vessels that makes increasing potassium intake so uniquely effective for managing hypertension.
Okay, so we've got the cellular dance, the mechanics, and why the imbalance is a problem. But does this simple swap idea actually translate into real world, life-saving benefits? This is where the clinical evidence really matters, right?
Absolutely. And the science here isn't just theoretical. It's backed by some really robust clinical evidence. For instance, there was a large meta-analysis, looked at 21 trials with almost 32,000 participants. It confirmed really significant blood pressure lowering effects. Using potassium enriched salt led to an average reduction of about 4.6 millimeter Hg in systolic blood pressure and about 1.6 millimeter Hg in diastolic blood pressure. Those are meaningful drops. And then there's the Deside Salt trial. This one focused specifically on older adults in China. It showed that using a salt substitute resulted in a 40% lower incidence of developing hypertension. And importantly, it did this without increasing the risk of hypotension, blood pressure getting too low, which can sometimes be a concern in that age group. And if we connect this to the bigger picture, it's not just about the blood pressure numbers. These substitutes are actually reducing major cardiovascular events and overall mortality. The real landmark study here is the salt substitute and stroke study, often called ESSIS. It was huge, followed nearly 21,000 Chinese adults, all with a history of stroke or high blood pressure for almost 5 years. They used a blend that was 75% regular salt, 25% potassium chloride, and the results were, well, quite remarkable. They found an 11% reduction in major cardiovascular events, things like stroke and heart attack, an 11% reduction in death from any cause, and a 13% reduction specifically in cardiovascular mortality. There were even follow-up analyses suggesting it was significantly more likely to prevent things like acute coronary syndrome, heart failure, arrhythmias, and a sudden death than it was to cause any problems.
Wow, that 11% reduction in all-cause mortality.
Yeah.
It's incredible for just, changing the type of salt you use. We hear so often about dietary changes being hard to stick with, right? That they fail because people just stop doing them. What's the secret sauce here, beyond just the biochemistry? Do the trials tell us anything about long-term adherence? How well did people stick with it?
That's a really crucial point, Host, and it's where these salt substitutes truly shine, I think, that big SAS trial. It reported an impressive 92% adherence rate to using the salt substitute after 5 years, 92%. That level of sustained use is frankly remarkable for any dietary intervention study. And it's largely attributed to what we discussed earlier, the similar taste profile of potassium chloride to sodium chloride for most people. This practical simplicity combined with the high adherence it enables is what makes it such a potentially powerful population-level strategy for preventing and controlling hypertension and cardiovascular disease. It kind of sidesteps that whole "it doesn't taste good" problem that plagues so many healthy eating initiatives.
Okay, so the benefits are clear. Really compelling, even. Lower blood pressure, fewer strokes, lower mortality, and people actually stick with it. But this naturally raises a really important question. Are there any downsides? Is there a catch? When can this seemingly good thing become, well, dangerous?
Yes, this is indeed the critical caveat, and it's absolutely paramount that everyone understands this part. The primary safety concern, the big one, is hyperkalemia. That means dangerously high levels of potassium in the blood. Technically, it's defined as blood potassium above 5.5 millimoles per liter. Symptoms usually start showing up above 6.0, and it can become genuinely life-threatening at levels over 6.5. Symptoms might include things like muscle weakness, numbness, maybe heart palpitations, shortness of breath, even chest pain. But the most critical complication, the one we worry about most, is cardiac arrhythmia. Irregular heartbeats. Because the heart's electrical system, its resting membrane potential, is incredibly sensitive to potassium concentrations. Too high, and it can lead to heart block or even cardiac arrest. And here's the, well, the paradox, really. The very people who stand to benefit the most from lowering sodium and increasing potassium, those with hypertension, often older adults, they're also often the ones at the highest risk for developing this hyperkalemia if they suddenly increase their potassium intake without caution. This just highlights the absolute necessity of a thorough medical evaluation, especially checking kidney function, before someone starts using these substitutes, particularly if they have underlying health issues. So, who are these key at-risk populations? Well, number one is individuals with advanced kidney disease. The kidneys are the primary way our body gets rid of excess potassium. If kidney function is severely impaired, the body simply can't excrete it effectively. For these individuals, potassium-containing salt substitutes are generally considered a direct contraindication. They shouldn't use them. Patients with heart failure are also at higher risk. Hormonal imbalances associated with heart failure can reduce the body's ability to excrete potassium. And for people with diabetes, particularly if it's poorly controlled, insulin deficiency can prevent potassium from moving properly into the body's cells, leading to higher levels circulating in the blood. Beyond those conditions, there are also critical medication interactions that can seriously compound the risk. Certain common drugs significantly increase the danger. We're talking about ACE inhibitors, drugs like lisinopril, angiotensin sector receptor blockers, or ARBs like losartan, potassium-sparing diuretics like spironolactone or amiloride, and even common over-the-counter non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, NSAIDs like ibuprofen or naproxen, can sometimes impair potassium excretion. Combining salt substitutes with these medications requires extreme caution, careful monitoring, or in many cases, it's just contraindicated altogether and needs careful medical guidance.
That's a lot of crucial detail. Those interactions sound really important to know about. Can you maybe give us a real-world example, something that illustrates what happens when these warnings aren't heeded, or maybe when that vital communication breaks down somewhere?
Yes. Unfortunately, there are stark examples. There's a well-documented case study of a 74-year-old woman. She had end-stage renal disease, meaning her kidneys had basically failed, and she required regular hemodialysis to survive. Despite being on dialysis, she experienced two separate cardiopulmonary arrests. Her heart stopped due to severe hyperkalemia. It was only after the second near-fatal event that doctors discovered she had been regularly using a popular potassium-containing salt substitute, lost salt, I believe it was in this case. She was completely unaware of its high potassium content, or crucially, her own body's severely diminished capacity to handle and excrete that extra potassium load because of her kidney failure. This case really highlights a critical failure, often in the chain of care and communication. Patients might not be informed about the potassium content, or they might not think to mention using a salt substitute. And sometimes healthcare providers might not specifically ask about these common over-the-counter products. It's a powerful reminder of why that awareness and conversation is just so vital on both sides.
Right. Really sobering example. So we have these amazing potential benefits, but also these very real specific dangers. What does this all mean for public health then? How do we get these benefits to more people safely? It sounds like there's a pretty big gap right now between the science showing effectiveness and what's actually happening in everyday life or in the clinic.
There definitely is a gap. And we do have clear global and national guidelines for sodium and potassium intake, which underscore the need for change. The WHO, for example, recommends getting sodium under 2,000 milligrams a day and boosting potassium to at least 3,510 milligrams daily. Their target is a sodium to potassium ratio in the diet of less than or equal to 1.0. Most Western diets are way off that. The American Heart Association suggests an even tighter ideal sodium limit, maybe 1,500 milligrams, and recommends aiming for 3,500 to 5,000 milligrams of potassium. The CDC recommendations are broadly similar. The goals are clear. But despite this strong scientific evidence and these clear guidelines, you're right. There's a significant disconnect. Public awareness and adoption of potassium-enriched salt substitutes remain very low in most places. Why? Well, it seems to be a combination of factors. First, just a general lack of public awareness. Many people simply don't know these substitutes exist or understand the potential benefits. Second, limited availability. They're apparently marketed in only about 47 countries worldwide. And even where they are available, they might be hard to find, maybe relegated to a small health food section rather than being right next to regular salt. And third, cost is a real issue. They are typically more expensive, sometimes significantly so. I've seen figures suggesting up to 15 times the cost of regular iodized salt in some markets. That's a major barrier, especially for lower income populations who might also be at higher risk of hypertension.
Okay, so awareness, availability, cost. Those are pretty significant hurdles. Given that, How do we move beyond just relying on individual consumers making that choice? Are there bigger, maybe system-level changes that can make a difference here?
That's a great question. And actually, that Deeside salt trial we mentioned earlier provided a really crucial insight there. They found that providing the salt substitute directly to the kitchen staff in residential care facilities. So changing the salt used in food preparation for everyone had a much greater impact on residents' blood pressure than simply relying on individuals to choose it. This really points towards the potential of a system-level approach. Imagine if the food industry itself more widely adopted these potassium-enriched blends and processed foods. You know, the vast majority of our sodium intake doesn't come from the salt shaker. It comes from processed and prepared foods. Companies like Cargill are already offering these kinds of salt potassium chloride blends to food manufacturers, allowing for up to 50% sodium reduction in products without, usually, a major taste difference. And taste is key here. Reassuringly, most large-scale studies find that the majority of consumers find the taste of these substitutes acceptable, especially the blends, not the pure potassium chloride ones. While it's true some individuals might perceive a slight metallic or bitter aftertaste, particularly with higher potassium concentrations, the general acceptance is pretty good, and that taste acceptability is vital. It really distinguishes this intervention from others that demand a significant reduction in overall saltiness, which many people find unpalatable and hard to stick with long-term.
Right. So pulling all this together, then, the clear benefits for blood pressure and mortality, the high adherence because the taste is okay, but balanced against these really serious risks of hyperkalemia for certain groups, and then the practical challenges of awareness, cost, and availability. Is this truly the game changer it kind of appears to be on paper? Or are those hurdles just too high to expect widespread impact?
I think it's genuinely both. The scientific evidence, it's overwhelming now. It strongly supports the dual benefits of these substitutes, reducing sodium, increasing potassium. This directly addresses that core dietary imbalance driving so much hypertension and cardiovascular disease globally. We have landmark trials like SASIS showing unequivocally that it not only lowers blood pressure, but also significantly reduces major events like stroke, heart failure, and overall mortality. That's huge. And critically, the high long-term adherence rates, mainly because of the similar taste profile, confirm its potential as a highly effective population-wide strategy, which is rare in dietary interventions. However, and it's a big however, this brings us right back to that critical clinical and public health challenge. The significant, potentially life-threatening risk of hyperkalemia in specific vulnerable populations, those with advanced kidney disease, certain types of heart failure, diabetes, or those taking specific common medications, we cannot ignore that risk. And then there's the systemic failure. We've discussed the failure so far to effectively translate this proven science into widely adopted public health benefit. That's largely down to that lack of awareness, the limited market availability, and the cost barriers. So yes, it's potentially a game changer, but one with very clear conditions for safe use and significant implementation challenges that need to be overcome.
Okay, so it sounds like we need a really careful, multi-layered approach to move forward. One that captures the benefits while actively managing the risks and helps you, our listener, navigate this safely if it's appropriate for you.
Exactly. It needs action on several fronts. For healthcare providers, doctors, nurses, pharmacists, it means being proactive. Consider recommending potassium-enriched salt substitutes to your patients, especially those who are generally healthy or have hypertension but have no contraindications. But this recommendation must be preceded by a thorough assessment. Check their kidney function, like a basic metabolic panel, and carefully review all their medications, looking out especially for those ACE inhibitors, ARBs, potassium-sparing diuretics, and potentially chronic NSAID use. And crucially, patient education is key. Explaining the signs and symptoms of hyperkalemia and stressing the importance of regular monitoring if they start using it, especially if they have any borderline risk factors. Then, for policymakers and public health officials, there's a big role to play. They need to launch comprehensive public health campaigns. Educate the public about the importance of the sodium to potassium ratio in their diet and make people aware that these substitutes are an option. They should also actively explore policies to increase market availability and, importantly, affordability. Maybe subsidies or mandating placement alongside regular salt, and perhaps most impactfully, encourage or even incentivize that system-level adoption by the food industry and processed foods. That could passively improve diets on a massive scale. And finally, for the food industry itself, there's a clear opportunity, perhaps even an imperative, to voluntarily adopt these potassium-enriched salt blends much more widely in manufacturing. This could passively improve the nutritional profile of the entire food supply, benefiting potentially millions of consumers without requiring individual action.
So it's clear. Potassium-enriched salt substitutes represent a really powerful yet quite nuanced tool in the public health toolkit. They promise truly life-saving benefits for many, but fully understanding the risks and ensuring safe, informed application is absolutely paramount.
It really is. And maybe a final thought for you, the listener, to consider. Given the immense potential of this relatively simple dietary change to save lives on a large scale, and given the clear, albeit specific, risks involved, how do we as a society ensure that such a powerful public health tool is leveraged both safely and equitably? How do we make sure everyone who could benefit safely can do so without inadvertently harming those who are most vulnerable? What role do you play in fostering that informed environment, maybe in your own family or community?
That's a great question to ponder. And just a final reminder from us, this deep dive is designed to empower you with knowledge. But before making any significant changes to your diet, especially something like switching your salt, it is always best practice to consult with qualified health and dietary professionals. Maybe even get a second opinion. Ensure you receive the best, most well-rounded guidance tailored specifically for your unique health situation.